This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Activist Chris Crass was in Battle Creek last week to discuss his idea of collective liberation from racism and sexism. Andy Robbins' interview with Chris Crass is coming up. But first, commentator Gary Wilson sees a common theme in a trio of stories: elevated levels of lead in Flint drinking water, what he calls a study of the obvious on pipeline safety, and ineffective actions to protect Lake Erie from algae blooms. That theme is the lack of a strong, aggressive Department of Environmental Quality in Michigan. Wilson's latest Chicago View column for Great Lakes Echo is called "The Sorry State of Michigan's Environmental Watchdog." Gary Wilson, thank you for being with us.
Hey, Gordon. Good to be back with you.
How much is this a new problem that we have a watchdog which is supposed to be keeping track of environmental issues in Michigan, which, as you say, is not really doing its job right now?
I don't think it's necessarily new. You know, the DEQ, like many government agencies, they go along day to day and do their work. And a lot of it is, you know, low profile, important, but low profile work behind the scenes. Average citizens and even people like me who do pay attention to these things, you know, don't necessarily track what goes on a day-to-day basis. But, you know, Michigan, is, as we've talked about, is the Great Lakes State, and water is the essence of its identity. And so when things go wrong, you know, they are in the spotlight. And the Michigan DEQ here for some period of time has been on what I say is a losing streak in my Rolling Stones reference. And these are big issues. These aren't minor issues. So I think this is a trend versus just a blip in the road. And that's what's got me concerned.
Well, let's go through these one by one, if we can. The report on the pipeline, which goes through the Straits of Mackinac, owned by Enbridge Energy. Now, there are some environmental groups which have said that at least there are some good recommendations in that report. But you say, to use another pop culture reference here, to the TV show Seinfeld, this is really a report about nothing. Is there really nothing of value in this report at all?
I don't think, I exaggerate just a bit to make a point, but I don't think there's much of a value here. The main recommendation, and these are just recommendations, was that Enbridge not be allowed to move the heavy, dirty, nasty tar sands crude through the pipeline. And Enbridge does it now and has said that it wouldn't in the future. Beyond that, the report recommended more transparency. They were going to ask Enbridge for some more questions. And there would be some more study at the edges. That really doesn't do much. You know, some of the environmental groups in Michigan, National Wildlife Federation, and a few others, you know, were somewhat complimentary and said it's the step in the right direction. Sierra Club, though, who's also been tracking it, they kind of equated it to rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, some similar metaphor. So, you know, it's a study, and studies take time, and but nothing, not much came out of this.
So the Flint water crisis, obviously this has been an ongoing story in the state and pretty controversial, and now maybe headed to court. There's a couple of groups out there which are talking class action lawsuit. So let's just say for the moment here that we've kind of gotten past the point where it all could have been prevented. What's the thing for the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality to do now to try and address it?
I think there has to be a major overhaul of the way the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality looks at these things. You know, this is safe drinking water that we're talking about. You know, I can write about a lot of things that are important, and I do on Great Lakes issues. You know, everybody's interested in Asian carp. People are interested in, you know, restoring wetlands and all those things. But they don't grab people's attention like drinking water quality. When you get something like what happened in Toledo last year, with their drinking water problems, and now Flint, and this has been playing out over the course of over a year, that gets people's attention immediately because everybody is impacted by safe drinking water. The Michigan DEQ has direct responsibility over this, and, you know, it seems that they failed at almost every turn, and this is very egregious. you've got two investigations in process now. Governor Snyder has launched his own. The U.S. EPA is investigating this, and just this week there are two lawsuits. So I think there needs to be some serious inward looking at the MDEQ to look at their mission, get focused, and then, of course, to prevent the recurrence of what happened.
Well, you brought up preventing the recurrence of what happened in Flint. Obviously, no one wants to see the drinking water in their town end up with higher levels of lead or anything else that shouldn't be in there. Do we need to be testing more often? I mean, could we, for instance, if we had more testing, might we be somewhat disturbed by the results and find these things more often, but perhaps quicker before people are drinking a lot of this water, which they shouldn't be drinking?
Well, I think they should definitely look at the testing procedures, and as a precautionary measure, I would say yes, sure. Testing is more testing is warranted, at least in the short term, which may be a year or two. But, you know, there was one thing that came out of this was a gap, and this is where the DEQ with oversight responsibility and the U.S. EPA, who has also has oversight responsibility on this, and the Detroit News reported about the gap with schools. Schools assume that if Flint or another municipality is pumping water into their system, that it's safe. And Flint and many municipalities across the region, they say, hey, we investigate with schools if we get a complaint. Those are the types of things that, going forward to prevent reoccurrences, really need to be looked at. That's a significant gap. It affects kids. And these are the types of things that the DEQ, and I hope Governor Snyder's report, will address.
Now, the DEQ has also been working on protecting Lake Erie from algae blooms. You write that it'll tweak things at the sewage treatment plants in and near Detroit, but not much more. You say that sounds good, but the reality is that the Detroit River has little impact on the toxic blooms. How does a state agency work at a problem and yet seem to get so far away from the real core of the problem?
The core of the problem, that's a great question, Gordon. The core of the problem with Lake Erie is the runoff from agriculture. It's not the Detroit River. And Michigan and Ohio and other states all over the country are loath to challenge farmers, the agricultural industry, over their practices. But as Don Scavia, who I quote in the article, a scientist from the University of Michigan, says, that the concentration of phosphorus in the Detroit River is too low to stimulate the blooms. He also told me that the Detroit River does contribute, Detroit River outflow does contribute to the dead zone in Lake Erie, and of course, you know, that needs to be addressed. But the way I read this with their pronouncements, the DEQ is, if they're not saying it, they're implying that the tweaks that they're making at the sewage plants will help with the algae problem in Lake Erie. And here's University of Michigan's top Great Lakes scientist saying that's not the case. There's another gap, and these are the type of things that the DEQ needs to be addressing.
How much is it fair to blame this particular agency, the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, and how fair is it to maybe say it goes a little higher? You note, for one thing, that Governor Snyder himself signed off on the task force to do the study on the Straits of Mackinac. I mean, at some point, does the state agency just simply reflect the actions of the executive, or at least the interest that that executive is taking and the focus that executive has on their particular line of work?
It does. You know, I spent a number of years, decades in corporate life, and I saw big corporation, and I saw corporate cultures change depending on who the chief executive was. And the chief executive doesn't necessarily give the orders down to the ranks of middle management, which is sort of where I would see the DEQ, but they set the tone. Governor Snyder, especially related to Flint, was aware of the problem way back in January, and that is before the lead issue had surfaced. There were other drinking water quality questions raised, and very publicly. NPR covered it. The New York Times has done at least a couple of articles on it. So Flint's problems are getting national attention. At that point, if I'm Governor Snyder, I call a timeout and say, hey, guys, what's going on? I call Dan Wyant, the director at the DEQ, and I say, what's going on? We've got, drinking water, protecting drinking water, providing safe drinking water is at the very essence, the very core of what governments do or supposed to do. And, they failed to do that in Flint. And so the short answer to your question is, I think Governor Snyder bears a direct responsibility on this. And in the one lawsuit, he is named, as is Director Wyant from the MDEQ. So they're going to have to defend themselves now.
Going back to that opening line of your column, Can't You See I'm on a Losing Streak, which Rolling Stones fans will recognize is from the song Satisfaction. To be fair here to the DEQ, are they perhaps unfortunate in that these things are so stacked together? If one of these problems were 2 years ago and one of these problems were 4 years ago, and then we had one now, might we look at the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality a little differently than we look at them when we have these three issues all come together in such a short period of time?
I don't think so, Gordon. It's part of a mindset. And I think at some point, everybody meets their Waterloo. And with Flint, it may be Governor Snyder's and the DEQ's Waterloo. Okay, they tiptoed around fracking with a study, and there haven't been any major fracking problems, at least that we're aware of. They did a study and a white paper on what Michigan's water should be. They've done a study, and thank heavens that there hasn't been a problem yet at the Straits of Mackinac. So I think maybe they perceive they've had some success with their actions and their strategies. So they kind of deflected the Flint issue, and now it's caught them, and they've run out of time on this. And with two investigations and two lawsuits pending, I would hope that the governor himself takes responsibility for this. And I think the DEQ has to have its mission and its way of operating examined, and hopefully they'll come out the other side all the better.
On the bigger issue of how the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality enforces the various regulations that Michigan has for drinking water and just water quality in general, if Gary Wilson's phone rang and it was Rick Snyder or someone else high up in the state of Michigan's government asking, how do we do this better, what would Gary Wilson's answer be?
Good question, Gordon. I've thought about this a lot, and I had a colleague give me a little bit of criticism over my answer to him, and that was just between us. But I think the DEQ's problems are such that, with all due respect to the gentleman, but Dan Wyant needs to be replaced. The governor, counts on the people that run the agencies to serve the citizens and to serve him. And I would say that Mr. Wyant has done neither effectively, especially in the Flint situation. I can't tell you how many people, the citizens and sort of the Great Lakes intelligentsia, have told me how egregious this Flint issue is, this Flint problem is. So, again, with all due respect to Mr. Wyant, I think he needs to be replaced. And beyond that serious examination of what the DEQ does, that would be my advice to the governor.
Gary Wilson, as always, thank you for your time.
Good to be with you again. Thanks, Gordon.
Gary Wilson's latest Chicago View column for Great Lakes Echo is called The Sorry State of Michigan's Environmental Watchdog. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Activist Chris Crasp says racism and sexism are not inevitable. He was in Battle Creek last week to discuss his idea of collective liberation. WMUK's Andy Robbins spoke with Chris Crass before two events held in Battle Creek.
Chris, I'd like you to explain what you mean by that term, collective liberation.
Yeah, collective liberation is a vision for multiracial democracy, for economic justice for all, essentially a vision of why white people should be committed to working against racism, why men should be working for feminism, and eliminating these inequalities, the structural inequalities, the cultural inequalities. We create a society that is much healthier, much more dynamic, much more beautiful for all of us. And so collective liberation is a way of uniting people who are overwhelmingly divided currently in society. White people from people of color around feminism, oftentimes men seeing it as something where it's, feminists hate men, looking past those divisions to see what is the unity of feminism for all of us, of racial justice for all of us, of LGBT rights for all of us, really being able to see how we can create a society that truly loves and respects and resources all of our children, all of our elders.
What are the biggest obstacles, do you think, to for example, getting people who are white to be concerned about issues of racism affecting those who are not white?
The development of racism in the United States, a lot of times it gets mistaken as being inevitable, as being natural. But the truth is that racism has been creeping into our society as a way of dividing indentured European servants from enslaved Africans, from dividing working class and poor white people from working class communities of color, to work for economic justice for all, to work for health care for all. The slave masters in the early development of this country purposefully divided Europeans from Africans in fear of working people, everyday people coming together to demand a society that respects and resources and shares the wealth with all of us, the wealth that their labor was producing. So racism then creates a death culture that poisons the hearts of white people to see, turns white people's capacity for love into an engine of hate and resentment towards people of color. So really being able to try to tap into what that resentment, that anger, that fear that racism breeds within white communities, and really seeing it as the poison or the cancer that it is, and being able to talk to white people about how this is really negatively impacting our lives, our communities, our children, how racism is deforming our humanity, and really being able to then, for me as a white person, a big part of my work is to create a different kind of leadership in white communities that is for racial justice, that is against racism. Because far too often, I know as a kid, the visible leadership that I saw in white communities was often racist, or at least antagonistic to racial justice. So a different kind of leadership in white communities that identifies racial justice as a goal for all of us. A different kind of leadership amongst men that identifies and understands and can communicate why feminism is a way of increasing all of our capacities to live a more healthy life, a more connected community-based life in our families and in our society.
You've said that you work from or try to organize from a place of love, as you put it.
A lot of times, as a white person, you start to come into consciousness about the horrors of racism, and it's really devastating to learn about, to really truly look at the history of slavery, of genocide and colonization in the United States, and to really develop a lot of anger or guilt or shame around the history and legacy and current realities of racism. And so for me as a white person is really being able to tap into also there's been a long history of white people who have stood for racial justice, who have stood for multiracial democracy, who have joined with the Black liberation struggle and other communities of color in struggles for a better world. And so to really develop a sense of love for myself But then for other white people, and knowing that, you know, white people overwhelmingly do not make a conscious choice of, yes, I want to embrace an agenda of hate. Yes, I want to have this death culture of racism be shaping my family. But racism really is an attack on white people's hearts and minds to turn them into soldiers of racism. And so to really be able to see that for what it is, and to be able to love communities, and in this case, white communities, to be able to love the visions and aspirations within white communities, and to see how racism is a barrier and an assault on the humanity of white people that needs to be removed. And so to really see love as a powerful force, love as a way of being able to connect to other people's most cherished values, and being able to work from a place of love for this vision of collective liberation, a vision of beloved community, a vision of a better world, as opposed to only focusing on, you know, ways that white people, you know, have white privilege, or ways that white people support this, you know, racist system, which are also important aspects to look at, the ways that white people do experience privilege, the ways that economic and cultural institutions in the society do value white lives over black lives, but to also see the ways that racism is really creating a death culture in white communities that needs to be ended.
So you don't feel that, for example, constantly telling someone who is white to, as they say, check your privileges is necessarily very productive?
Well, a lot of times, you know, there's a lot of working class white folks who, you know, have really been seeing wages decrease, resources in our communities being taken away, budget cuts, and, you know, corporations taking previously unionized or well-paying jobs, taking those jobs out of the country. And so there's a lot of white folks that are really scrambling economically and are angry, rightfully angry. And so sometimes if it's just like a check your privilege to those to white folks who are really struggling, it can create a resentment and kind of a, well, who are you to be telling me to check my privilege? So I don't usually start with check your privilege. I start with, you know, let's check our humanity. Let's check our values. Let's check our aspirations and dreams and how racism is really destroying the values that are core to many, many, many white people. And then learning about privilege is a part of that journey because, yes, I mean, the ways that the police, the ways that the criminal justice system, the ways that the courts treat white people is very different to how African Americans are treated, which is why we have the Black Lives Matter movement right now. So being able to see the ways that white privilege gets in the way of white people listening, believing, hearing the experiences of black people, and then joining in the Black Lives Matter movement is real. And I also, as an anti-racist, want to be communicating a vision of economic justice and multiracial democracy for all that can really resonate and move white people's hearts and minds in a way that then connects to this collective liberation vision and doesn't make white people feel like they're just obstructionists to justice and that their only role they can play is to stop being such haters. We also need to help support white people to see how much they can love justice, love the fight right now for a $15 minimum wage and how that is better for all of us. To support white people to love how the Black Lives Matter movement is the front line civil rights movement of our time that's expanding the possibility of a better world for all of us. For white people to be able to see how the Black Lives Matter movement fundamentally is advancing a love ethic, a beloved community ethic, and a human dignity ethic that will be better for all of us. So that's part of how I do my work, is really trying to bring white communities into multiracial movements for a democratic society that truly values, that truly incorporates and institutionalizes equality.
At the risk of oversimplifying, would you agree that the emphasis you believe should be on structural racism rather than on monitoring, you know, individual faux pas by specific people?
I mean, the individual faux pas, you know, that that's the result of growing up in a culture where institutional racism has shaped the language, has shaped the worldview. And so for me, it's about structural racism. It's not about asking, you know, this whole question is sort of like, are these individual white people racist or not? That's not the fundamental question. The question is, what are we doing to change structural, institutional, cultural racism in the society? So institutional racism essentially creates a conveyor belt that white people are on, and that conveyor belt is moving towards an agenda of racism, an agenda of white supremacy. And so even if you're not consciously making a choice to move towards supporting racism, that conveyor belt, because of institutional racism in the economy, in healthcare, in education, that conveyor belt is moving white people. So oftentimes you have white people who will say, but I'm not racist, but they're still on that conveyor belt perpetuating racism. So our question is, what can we do to end structural racism and work for racial justice? So the question isn't, are you or aren't you a racist? The question should be, are you or aren't you working for racial justice? Because we need to be making conscious choices of where we are putting our time, our energy, our values to work. Because right now, for white people who are just saying, well, you know, Obama is president, and the Black Lives Matter movement is, perpetuating, is exaggerating, that is essentially supporting a racist system, you know, the colorblind post-racial society. That is all supporting the maintaining of institutional racism. So the question isn't, are you or aren't you a racist? The question is, are you or aren't you working for racial justice? And if you're not working for racial justice, then either consciously or unconsciously, you're giving support to institutional racism in this death culture of white supremacy.
I wanted to touch on something that you have mentioned previously before we go, and that is your involvement in efforts to enlist men in the fight for the rights of women. And you consider that sort of part of just one ongoing struggle, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, sexism raises men to be so emotionally disconnected from our lives, from our pain, our grief, our frustrations. And so the only emotions that men are encouraged or rewarded to express in the society are violence, rage, jealousy. And so it's no wonder that mass shootings all over this country are being done overwhelmingly by white men who are raised in this, you know, again, this death culture of sexism and racism, to internalize so much anger and resentment and to blame women or to blame LGBT folks or to blame Muslims or to blame people of color or immigrants for all of these failings, which are truly about economic inequality. I mean, the 1% in this country and the unbelievable economic disparities in this country are being externalized by young white men as anger towards people who they should be aligning themselves with. And so sexism is something that, again, tears apart our family. It turns men into, you know, again, using violence against people that they most love, using violence as a way of dealing with the challenges in life. So feminism is an opening up of possibility for men to truly be leaders, to truly be loving partners in creating a community that that our values and our kids, our elders, would be raised in a healthy way. And so, again, sexism deeply disconnects men from the ability to build a healthy, democratic society that embraces equality culturally and institutionally.
Chris, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
WMUK's Andy Robbins spoke with Chris Crass last week. Crass spoke at two events in Battle Creek. His appearance was sponsored by Kellogg Community College's Center for Diversity and Innovation. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.